You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning, I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News. This hour, how to teach your kids about race and racism. We heard from a lot of you when we had sociologist Margaret Hagerman on a few months ago. Her research, explained in a book titled White Kids, delves into how we perpetuate racism through privilege and decision-making and poor communication. Listen to what Professor Hagerman had to say.
Certainly, I think a lot of the parents in the book who told me that they did not want to talk about race with their children, or that they didn't examine sort of race or racial privilege, or even inequality, you know, their kids were still developing ideas about race. I mean, they live in a country that is, as I argue, divided by race in many ways, but it's also a country that's structured by race. And so, you know, we have all kinds of patterns in our society at the structural level that kids notice. They notice that the, you know, makeup of the Senate and the makeup of NBA basketball teams, you know, from a perspective of race. And so, you know, to think that kids are somehow not noticing these things, I think is a little bit misguided, at least based on my research.
We took many, many calls from you about the best ways to communicate your values about race to your children. And we thought we needed another show on this, just to focus on this. So two guests this hour, and open lines for your questions and reflections on this. Have you considered how your decisions about your kids' schools and clubs and friends communicate your values about race to them? What happens when you and your kids bring up racism in your household? One of the things that Professor Hagerman learned was that parents often try to tamp down those conversations. They feel uncomfortable about them, and so they divert the discussion. If you think about how this goes in your own household, does that happen? How do you encourage a free and open conversation about racism? And have you considered how your own decisions about where your kids will attend schools, where they'll go to summer camp, the clubs, the friends that they have you considered how those decisions also communicate your values about race to your kids? Give it some thought. Join the conversation. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828, on Twitter at Carrie. It's K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Our guest this hour, Jamar Tisby, is with us, president of The Witness. It's a Black Christian collective based in Denver, Colorado, and the author of the forthcoming The Color of Compromise. And Jamar, welcome. It's really good to have you on the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here. I'm actually visiting Colorado, and I call home the Delta area about an hour south of Memphis.
Okay, good to know. Thank you. Anastasia Higginbotham is with us. She's the author of Not My Idea, a book about whiteness and other kids' books, and she's with us today from New York. And Anastasia, welcome to you. Good to have you on the show.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Jamar, one of the things that became pretty clear in our discussion with Margaret Hagerman was that parents want to communicate their values about this, but they say one thing and what they do ends up speaking volumes that they're not really cognizant to, that their kids are drawing conclusions from the things that their parents are doing and not just saying. Do you think most parents are aware of that?
I think that assessment is spot on. A lot of times when we think about race and racism, it's just that. It's thoughts. And we think that if we say the right things or think the right things about other people, then we've done our jobs. But what that does is ignores the sort of systemic and structural impediments to integration and equality that are all around us in America. And so it's not just a matter of changing belief. It's a matter of changing practice. As you've mentioned, where you live, where you go to school, who you interact with, all of those choices speak volumes. And as the saying goes, actions speak louder than words. So parents definitely have to be cognizant of that.
And one other thing that, as I mentioned in the introduction, Jamar, that came out of this discussion with Maggie Hagerman was parents feel uncomfortable, and rightly so. White parents feel uncomfortable having these conversations. They're fraught discussions these days, and we feel like we're going to say the wrong thing or communicate the wrong thing to our kids. So what is happening is, as I suggested, they're tamping down opportunities for this kind of conversation. I wonder if that resonates with you.
It does. And I'm glad you said white parents, because I think the dynamics are different for white parents versus parents of color. In many ways, especially for black parents, this is a topic you can't avoid, whether right. you feel comfortable with it or not. But another way to think of it, I think of it like the sex talk, right? Here's this really important topic that's very delicate and complicated, but it's something that they're going to encounter at some point. And so as parents, as adults, we want to equip our kids in the safest possible environment with as much information as we can to tackle these important issues. It's similar with race. The topic is so fraught that we should approach it with the appropriate amount of respect. We don't want to say the wrong thing that will actually be detrimental to other people. So that's incumbent upon us as adults to take responsibility and inform ourselves. But it's not a conversation we can avoid. And especially for white parents, you're actually doing harm in the sense that if you're not equipping your kids to maneuver issues of race intelligently, it could reflect badly. It could end up badly for kids of color and other people in society.
Yeah, Anastasia, I got the sense that you were thinking about this as you created the storyline for your newest book, because there's this scene where our young protagonist's mother says something to her like, oh, no, we don't see color. I think they're riding in the car. And the mother says, we don't see color in this family. And that's puzzling to the young girl in the story. Mm-hmm. So what were you thinking about on this?
Exactly what both Jamar has said and Maggie Hagerman. The impulse to tamp down those conversations and to divert the conversation is where this book, Not My Idea, a book about whiteness, begins. So the child has seen an incident of police brutality on their parent's TV screen. And immediately the parent wants to shut it down, shut off the TV screen, whatever the question is that the child is curious about, the parent is just focused on, like, you're safe, you're all right. And it's not satisfying to the child. The child is very upset and tuning into racial injustice and violence. And, yes, I wanted to show what that looks like when, in white families, a child is tuning in, but the parents are tuning it out and really turning the child away from their own impulse toward connection and curiosity.
Yeah, Anastasia, do you think the reason for that is kind of what Jamar suggested, is this is going to be uncomfortable, I may say the wrong thing, and I don't want this to be confusing for my child. I don't want to cause them, I don't know, confusion or or pain in having to talk about these things that are hard. That's kind of the instinct of the parent.
Yes, I get the instinct, and I just think that we've already done the wrong thing, and the children are already confused, and the only way to do right by them and to do right by our responsibility as white people who are caught up in a system of white supremacy, and we are on the oppressor side of the dynamic, it is an opportunity that we cannot afford to miss to embody that curiosity and that engagement and that total commitment to understand what are we part of and make conscious, informed decisions about undoing what should never have been done in terms of white supremacy and these structures that are set up to advantage my children.
Nancy says on Twitter, I think this goes to what you were just saying, Anastasia, my son is brown. I am not. I talked to him about the double standard he will face, about how to keep himself safe when we aren't together, about what it means to be a man of integrity and strength, about holding his head up and being a good human, about staying alive. Jamar, she's doing something powerful and important there. What do you hear in that?
It's interesting that in our work with The Witness, a lot of folks who follow us are white parents who have adopted children of color, whether African-Americans or international adoption. And that's a powerful experience because you have people who thought about race maybe in sort of a theoretical sense, in an abstract sense, but now it's literally in their homes. And that forces the issue because now this is somebody they're responsible for, someone who they love, and they're seeing race impact them, especially if they have multiple children, some biological who are white, and then some who are adopted and are brown or black skinned. They see the differences, whether it's at school and in the way teachers and other students treat them, whether it's out in public somewhere. And there's like a light bulb that goes on for these parents. It's like, oh, wow, this is truly real. And it affects the way my kids maneuver the world. And so that's one thing that we all have to realize is that you experience America differently based on your skin color a lot of times. And that's one of the things that's really hard to communicate to white parents as a black person is how different it is as a person of color in America. When you're thinking about something like police, law enforcement, and in charged to protect and serve, and we respect people who put their lives on the line to protect others. But at the same time, there's a long and very fraught relationship between law enforcement and communities of color. That can be hard to understand for a person who's never personally experienced it. And so sometimes the best way or even the only way for some parents is when it comes into their homes. But that's not sufficient for everyone, right? That's not going to be everyone's mm-hmm. experience. So it's incumbent upon us as American citizens just to understand that our neighbors are affected by different things than we are and to have some empathy because of that and attempt to educate ourselves.
Mick says, I'm white and the father of two black girls. We want to give our kids as much privilege as we can, but we want to make them aware of what their race represents. To the phones to Leah in Minneapolis. Leah, sounds like you're also in the situation we described, white parent of kids of color.
Yes, I have a son who is black, and obviously it's informed me in ways that I wouldn't be if that wasn't the case. What's interesting to me, though, is I'm raising my kids in Minneapolis, which I thought would be diverse, but they go to an almost all-white school.
Uh-huh.
And there are parents there that think just even talking about race is racism. And they want to think that in this liberal bubble in Minneapolis that racism isn't existing, but it's happening every day at our kids' schools.
So tell me how the conversation goes with you understanding that about schools and you also understanding kind of the essence of what we're talking about today. Now, how do you approach that in your household?
Well, we acknowledge color from day one. And a lot of parents, it's again, oh, I'm colorblind, I don't see race. We talk about race, and because my son is black, right now he's a cute little black boy, but he's going to grow up and be a black man, and he's going to be discriminated against by law enforcement potentially. So we have to talk about all the precautions that he's going to have to take because of the color of his skin.
I really appreciate the call. Thanks for taking a moment to call in. I want to hear from Tony in Minneapolis. Hi, Tony. How does this work in your family, in your household?
So I'm a parent of black children, and the conversation amongst myself and the black parents that I know is significantly different than that. As Jamar said, the conversation about race is a matter of survival and being able to thrive. And so one of the pieces of feedback I wanted to give, and that I appreciate Jamar doing it already, was to really focus on that the research by Haberman was about white parents and parenting white children around race. From my perspective as a black parent and as a trainer and consultant in this area, mm-hmm. what I notice is a norming of white parenting as just parenting.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that inhibits white parents from being able to, and white children, be able to look at and understand having white skin color actually means something. And what does that mean? At least starting there. Because there's deeper ends of this conversation that I think are way too much for folks when it just first start out talking about race. But our inability to say that this is a conversation about white parents and about white parenting takes away, I think, that opportunity for white parents and children to say, you know, what does it mean to have white skin in this world as parents and children? And just to start there mm-hmm. and understanding what it means and beginning to norm that it's okay to have that conversation before you even get into white privilege
I've got it.
Or some other things.
Right, yeah. Right. Jamar, does that make sense to you?
It absolutely does. I mean, one of the things to think about is sort of the developmental stages of kids. What I find really helpful is racial identity development, a model used in psychology and social psychology about sort of the spectrum of awareness that people, not just kids, but people are on. Because I can remember as an undergraduate in college, I was just starting to be aware of these things. I had come from a very racially and ethnically diverse environment. We had a lot of Spanish speakers in my high school. We had a lot of folks from Southeast Asia. And so even though I was in sort of this college prep program that was much more racially homogenous, I was used to walking out in the halls in my high school and seeing sort of, you know, the plethora of colors represented there. And then when I became an undergrad, I was part of an African-American population that was only 3% of the student body. And so suddenly I'm thrust into this situation where I have to think about race differently. I had already thought about being black because we had already had some situations as black teenagers. But in this environment, I felt really unprepared and under-equipped. And I had to educate myself and ask other people and find mentors on staff and on faculty who could help me. And I think that's important to remember because where we dive into this conversation is important. And especially for younger kids, it's critical simply to acknowledge different. Hey, people look different. What do you think about that? And by the way, that's okay. So we avoid this idea of colorblindness, which really flattens out all of our beautiful differences in terms of culture and food and language. So we want to say that there is difference and then say that that difference can be good and then walk our kids deeper into the ways American society in particular has twisted color to mean really negative things for darker skinned people.
Anastasia, do you want to add something to that? Yeah.
Yes. I just, the line about colorblindness, our family doesn't see color. In the book, the child is actually coloring in a picture of the shooting that they just saw.
That's right.
And it's so apparent that the child sees color and is choosing colors. And it's also the problem with that is that it is a lie. The parent is who claims that. I understand that it's in the culture and it's in our brains now to say that or to think that that's what we're supposed to say.
And that's somehow supposed to be ennobling, right, Anastasia? You know, somewhere we got the idea that that was the noble way to be.
Right. And it is twisted. It is twisted because it denies the richness and the truth and the variety of experiences that we're all having, including these different experiences of when I am white and I walk into a store with my child, and when a parent is black and walks into a store with their child, we are having two different experiences. And yes, I made images in this book that would make it very apparent and make it easy for white parents to go page by page and show this is where whiteness shows up. This is how your skin color is affecting the way that you're received into rooms and seen on sidewalks.
Let me talk about one of the other scenes where you're doing this. I think so effectively. There's a scene where the girl who's featured, what remind me what her name is?
There's, you know, I don't name the
children.
You don't,
that's why I can't remember the name. Okay.
Yes, you can't, and I don't even gender them. I just let it be. You know, it's a way of me practicing just saying the child. But okay. Go ahead, you can see a girl, and that's just fine.
You can see the child has come to, I think it's a relative's house, maybe her aunt's house, and she has to go through a neighborhood where there is a social justice protest going on. Mm-hmm. And when she gets to her aunt's house or apartment, the aunt is like, oh, my gosh, are you okay? That was so scary. And boy, I think that is such a great way to show us how subtle what adults do and say reinforces this idea that if you're walking by a protest where people of color and white people are protesting, it's dangerous somehow and it's to be avoided.
Well, and as if that white child were the one in danger.
Right.
A person with brown skin was shot in presumably their town. This white child is not the one in danger. It is so warped. It's just, it's reversed. And it's very confusing to the child, who is actually concerned and very disturbed by the fact of having seen violence done by a police officer to a person who happened to have brown skin and their hands were up.
This is a conversation that comes from a discussion we had a few months ago with Margaret Hagerman on her research, explained and developed in a book called White Kids, and it delves into how we perpetuate racism through privilege and decision-making and poor communication. And she eavesdropped on kids talking about race and observed how parents, white, primarily for her research for this book, white parents, but we had a really good discussion overall about and got a lot of calls from parents saying, okay, how do I talk to my kids about race? Heard from a lot of white parents, heard from some parents of color who say, I have to approach this differently. So we thought we needed an additional conversation about this. Anastasia Higginbotham is with us. She's the author of Not My Idea, a book about whiteness. And Jamar Tisby is with us. He's president of The Witness and author of the forthcoming The Color of Compromise. And I'm asking you this morning to think about how your decisions about your kids' schools and clubs and friends, if you are a white family, communicate your values about race to them. What happens when you or your kids bring up racism in your household? And how does this change as a parent of color, as a white parent who is parenting kids of color? Talk to me about that, your experience across the board here, really important to the discussion. 651-227-6000-800-242-2828 on Twitter at Carrie NPR to Gala in Maplewood. Did I pronounce that right? I might not have.
It's Gala.
Gala. Hey, welcome. Yes. Good to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Sure. What'd you want to say?
Well, I called in because I heard your discussion on the way to work, and this is something we talk to our kids about all the time. Mm-hmm. I am the daughter of a Filipino immigrant and a white man, and my husband is African-American. We have two boys who are obviously multiracial, mm-hmm. 16 and 11, and they go to a mostly white school. We live in a pretty white neighborhood, mm-hmm. And so it's not optional to talk to our kids about race. Race is a part of our lives every single day. It has something to do with every aspect of our lives, and if we don't prepare our kids for that now, they're not going to know how to handle it when they're treated as a person of color after high school, out in the real world, whatever it may be. And something that I also wanted to say was that, you know, there's a lot of mixed kids that my sons are friends with at school. There's a lot of kids in our community who are black and white and maybe live with their white mother, mm-hmm. Or white parent. And it seems as though there's difficulty for those parents to talk to their. And I feel like this really does a disservice to those kids, because regardless of whether or not that's affecting them now, they will be treated as a person of color in larger society. I remember one time dropping my son off at an event in our community, and when I was about to let him out of the car, I noticed two police cars there. Mm-hmm. And so I had to hurry up and quick talk to him about how to be safe with the police in case something happens, because he was going to be out there, a bunch of teenagers together, black kids, and there's white police in our community. So I had to talk to him about that just, you know, before he ran out the car. And that's something that we don't have an option not to talk about, because as a person of color, when race is involved, that's decided for you, as opposed to if you're white, you kind of have the privilege of whether or not race has something to do with your conversation, with your life, with your everyday experience. And as a person of color, it's not optional. It's something that you live with, that you deal with every single day. And I don't think it's a bad thing. I think it makes our family stronger. I'm very proud of my kids for them, you know, being culturally aware. And I wouldn't change it for anything, but I just wanted to point out that it is difficult for families, mixed families in majority white communities.
Gala, I'm really glad you called. This is something that I wanted to bring up with Jamar, this fantastic piece, Jamar, that you wrote for The Atlantic in March. where you were driving with your son and you saw the turnoff to the Emmett Till Museum in Glendora, Mississippi. And you, I mean, somewhat like Gala, you have this moment of, now we have to have this discussion. And what's it going to be like for my child? Would you pick up the story there?
Right. So living in the South, the racial history of the United States is unavoidable. And I didn't know about this place. We were just driving from Jackson back up to the Delta, and I saw the sign. And I'm a PhD candidate in history at the University of Mississippi, so I'm a nerd about this stuff. Mm-hmm. So if it's just up to me, I always want to stop. I always want to explore. But I had my son, who at the time was 7 years old, in the back seat. And I'm like, this is one of the most gruesome lynchings in modern history. Is he ready? Am I ready to talk to him about this? Ultimately, I decided yes, that there has to be a way to do this that's appropriate for his age, but that's truthful. And it was also something I needed to do and something I needed to see. And so we turn off, and Glendora is this tiny one-street town, and it is haunted by the lynching of Emmett Till. And I spoke to the museum curator. This isn't an official state museum or anything. This is something the local residents have put together. And the museum curator, who's also the mayor of the town, is the son of one of the black people who, according to the son, said had to wash out the blood from the back of the truck from when they transported Emmett Till's body. And so I spoke to him, and meanwhile, my son is just wandering around, you know, picking up rocks and doing what kids do. But then I stop and I talk to him, and I said, do you know why we stopped here? And he's like, I don't know. And I said, because there was a little brown boy who looked a lot like you and a lot like me, and he was killed because of his skin color. And he just got real quiet. And it's really interesting how kids can sense something is really important, even if they don't fully understand it. Mm-hmm. So I don't know what he did with that, but he knows now. And I think these conversations are cumulative. So it can be intimidating if we think we have to communicate all the information and get all the way there to racial consciousness in one conversation. That's not going to happen. So I hope this was just adding a little bit more knowledge and information so that further along the road, he'll start to put it together.
One of the most tender moments of that piece for me was, I think you're describing what happened with Emmett Till, and your son asks, but it's not like that anymore, is it? What did you say?
I can't remember exactly what I said, but the answer is yes and no. So if you talk to civil rights activists, James Meredith was in my Sunday school class listening to me as if I had anything to teach him.
Wow.
I've heard from Merle Evers at the grand opening of the Mississippi Civil Rights Museum. They will tell you, activists who lived in the height of Jim Crow and the civil rights movement will tell you it's better. It's changed. Representative John Lewis in Georgia recently said this. Although there's gerrymandering and a lot of rollback of voter rights, we theoretically have that right. And this is what people were fighting for, integration, all these things. So, yes, things have changed. But at the same time, we just received news of yet another black man killed by law enforcement.
The security guard, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Assumed to be part of the problem, right? And so what I tell my son is that things changed, but it's always been a struggle. And we need to be part of that struggle because it's ongoing.
I guess I thought of that moment as so tender because you want to preserve your son's innocence and optimism, you know, for as long as is necessary, but it's also necessary to tell him and educate him about these things. It's just, when is the moment that he's going to start transforming into an adult? Maybe sooner than you want him to. You know what I'm saying?
Research shows that by the time my son, a little black boy, is 12, most people will perceive him to be at least 3 years older than he is. And so you can think of Tamir Rice in that same situation, a 12-year-old boy who was perceived to be a much more mature teenager and therefore a threat. That's one of the things that black parents have to talk to their kids about, is how, because of a long history of creating a mythology around blackness that's negative, black people, and especially males, will be perceived as threatening, as brutes, as intimidating, and that's going to put people on edge. And so, you know, if it's being in an elevator with a white woman, if it's encountering law enforcement, if it's, even we talk about, take the bass out of your voice when you talk to white people or you're on the phone, because that can sound scary, right? All of these little things. And it's hard to just say, OK, we're going to sit down and have a conversation about all of this. It sort of comes up in the moment.
Yeah.
I think what's important is for parents to have a posture of looking for teachable moments, because they're going to happen every single day. And it's incumbent upon us as adults to say, I'm going to be sensitive and aware to how we're maneuvering the world, and where there's opportunity, I'm going to add a little piece of knowledge to my child's brain to help him or her navigate this world in a racially conscious way that's empathetic and humane to other people.
We'll get a look at the latest news. We'll continue our conversation with Jamar Tisby and Anastasia Higginbotham, and you. Get in on the discussion, 651-227-6000, and on Twitter. I'll read some of the tweets that I'm getting here. Back to the conversation now. Anastasia Higginbotham with us. She's the author of Not My Idea, a book about whiteness, and it's a book for kids. And Jamar Tisby is with us, president of The Witness, a black Christian collective, and author of forthcoming The Color of Compromise. Jamar, that comes out in January. We could pre-order. Is that right?
That's exactly right. Thank you. You can
Absolutely.
Pre-order on Amazon right now.
Oh, my gosh. I'm a big bookie, so happy to promote the books. Mal says on Twitter, love the conversation today. I'm Latino. Parents are white. I was adopted. The way my parents have talked about race has improved over the years, but still it doesn't always click for them. They don't see the racism that I've faced or know the pain it causes. Luana says, I'm a white grandmother raising my granddaughters of color. Race relations have risen up and slapped me directly in the face. We don't talk about race in Minnesota nice, but we definitely see color. How differently we are treated when we are out together and when alone. End of the phones to Luz in Roseville. Hi, thank you so much for waiting. I'm glad you could do that. Tell me what
Good
you want to say.
Good Carrie. Morning, Carrie. And I want to emphasize what I keep hearing as an underlying theme with the callers coming in, and certainly the remarks from the two guests, which is the lack of empowerment that people feel to talk about race.
Yes.
So my question is, what are white people doing in general to empower themselves to be able to, it's like a muscle, right? When you need that muscle, you need to flex that muscle. But if you that yes. muscle doesn't exist, what have you done to build that muscle on race? I'm the CEO of YWCA Minneapolis, mm-hmm. and we have It's Time to Talk, which is an annual forum, and we are now launching It's Time to Act, which is a series of four conversations this year that begins December 4th to talk about race. And so, and we talk about systemic racism, we talk about white fragility, we have a number of very deep topics. These are the types of actions that can be proactively taken by everyone in our community, whether or not they're a parent, to empower themselves to be able to feel comfortable to talk about race.
Oh, Anastasia, yes, I hear you confirming all this that Luz is saying.
I love what she emphasize there. And I also want to point out that everyone who's called in so far is relating to racism as a problem that is being experienced by people of color and by black children, and even the white callers. And what I want to make sure is clear is that race is happening to white children, and racism is going into them. And we as white parents should be very concerned about the toxicity of the environment that our white children are being raised in, and we should be concerned about them acting out their racism as they grow up. So that is our incentive. It is not about being more, just more empathic and like and noticing that problem over there that's happening to those people. This is happening to us, and to the extent that we are ignorant of it and not educating ourselves, and to the extent that we are ignoring it or waiting for a good time to talk about it, the conversation is not just one, it's every day. And the practice is not just once, it's all the time. And I want to share a story, too, about talking to my child when he was six about trying to explain white supremacy and trying to explain the racist context that he was growing up in.
He was six years old when you were doing this?
6 years old.
Okay.
And I was very involved in, you know, I was going to protests and marches and writing about this and writing this book and making these pictures. And when I finished, he said, "So we're the bad color, but we're not bad people, right?" Hmm. And I thought, I've blown it. I somehow gave him the wrong takeaway. But, we're the bad color, we're not bad people, right? And I said, "Well, that depends. That depends on what we do with what we know." And I believe that. And my children understand that I am, and their father, we together are raising them to be conscious of where they live and what they experience and what they don't experience. And
Jamar, your reaction was interesting when Anastasia said, "I've blown it." How would you have heard the question that her son was asking, and how would you have answered it?
Say the question that her son asked again.
Yeah, it was. Go ahead.
So we're the bad color. We're the bad color, but we're not bad people, right?
I thought.
And I said, "Well, that depends."
Right. I thought that's incredibly insightful from a human being, let alone a six-year-old. I think. So this is really tough to understand, especially as I've talked to white people. There's the concept of whiteness itself, right, which includes all of the baggage and all of the mythology that we've created around skin color. And that is so, so negative and oppressive. And like Anastasia's saying, if I may use your first name, that affects white people as much as black people. So I think that's an extremely important point. And so I think there's a sense in which it's true that this concept of whiteness has been oppressive, but it's really perceptive to say that doesn't necessarily mean we're bad people in the sense that you can be white and still fight against whiteness and white supremacy. Your skin color does not automatically group you into moral or immoral as a person, like Anastasia says. It's what you do with that information. So I just thought it was really perceptive of her child to start to distinguish between the concept and the individual, and then how she as a mother carried it forward to say, well, now that you know these things, or as you're learning these things, what do you do with that? And that's what really sort of delineates between the justice and the injustice piece.
Anastasia, I was also, as you described, thinking I've really blown this. I was thinking about discussions that we've had with Robin DiAngelo, who writes about white fragility and is just incredibly wise. And she, you know, she comes at this by saying, be generous with yourself. You're going to make mistakes. Be determined. Be persistent. Right? So, but understand that you, and this, I feel like I listen to this advice a lot. I think about this advice a lot because I'm a white woman carrying on conversations, right, about race. I'm not always getting it right. And Robin kind of says, you know, that doesn't mean you turn away and say, okay, that didn't work out. So I kind of hear you also channeling that with what happened with your son.
Yes, the mistakes are inevitable, but they're not even, the only mistake really is to shy away from the whole thing.
That's
and
what she
that
says.
That's going to do anything but reinforce everything that's wrong. And it's so much about the body, too. It's not just words and what you can get from a book, but it's so much about embodying the fact that you care, the fact that it disturbs you, the fact that what gives you peace is justice, and what disturbs your sleep is injustice. And when you feel that, that's what you follow.
Ben says on Twitter, "I'm white. My wife is a person of color. My wife's experiences when she is out in public are vastly different when she's alone or with our kids than when I'm with her. Our kids see this. It's a daily conversation in our house, to the phones to Joe in Prior Lake. Hi, Joe. Thank you for waiting. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for having me. Hi. I just wanted to share that I'm a man of color and I'm raising three boys. And what's scary is when my wife first got pregnant, I hate to say this, but I was really hoping that I'll have a girl.
Really?
Because don't get me wrong. I love my boys to death. There's nothing I will do to replace all three of them. I have an 8, 5, and a 2-year-old right now. And it's scary because I know what's ahead of them. You know, sometimes I find myself worrying about them as they get older. And me and my wife right now, my 8-year-old, who goes to school with mostly Caucasian kids, mm-hmm. you know, has had an issue where he came home and said, "Dad, you know, I feel like I don't belong there." And that kind of breaks my heart because, you know, a kid shouldn't feel like that. And I don't think they're causing him to feel like that. And I didn't share this with your caller, but me and my wife 6 months ago sat down and we decided that actually we're going to move the kid to Africa where they can have their own kind of, they can make their mind up when it comes to about race. Because I feel like in the U.S., it kind of makes them think one way. And mm-hmm. I don't want my boys growing up thinking, this is the way I need to be, or this is the way I need to act, or this is how I need to carry myself. I just want them to kind of be brought up in a system where they feel like everybody, you can accept everybody, no matter who they are, how they pray, how they look.
That's a profound decision,
like,
isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, percent. Yeah, because I feel like in the U.S., we kind of force kids to think one way about race or who they are. And I've been to a store. There's a couple of stores I don't go to. If I want to buy something, I only go to outlet. Sometimes do I like to go there? No, but I just hate when I feel like I'm being followed. Or before I bought my house in Prior Lake, I got stopped 21 times the first year. I had to go to the local police department and say, "Hey, I live here.
Jeez.
What is going on?" And finally, it stopped. You know, and I have a lot of Caucasian friends that I went to school with that are very good people, and some of them don't understand because they don't experience it. It does not mean it doesn't exist. It's just that they got to be black to really experience it. It's really hard to explain to another person and say, "Hey, this is what I'm going through." They're going to look at you and say, "Oh, I don't see that." But unless you're a man of color, it's a scary world, and I'm scared for my boys, and that's what we're going to do. Me and my wife decided we're going to move them overseas and bring them back when they're more mature, and hopefully that will be something that they can learn how to adapt once they come back and have a strong opinion on who they are. And I feel like African-Americans who are in the U.S. right now, one thing they really miss is something called a base, who they are. And I feel like me taking my kids back home, I feel like they're going to find out who they are, where they came from, be proud of who they are, so when they come back, they're not ashamed of who they are, or they're not scared of who they are, or things like that.
Joe, I can really hear what a difficult decision that was. Jamar, I wonder about something that Joe said. You can try to explain this to people that aren't living it, but it's kind of impossible to explain. Is that right, do you think?
There's certainly a difficulty in explaining it, particularly to white people. Because whiteness functions to your advantage when you're white. And one of the things that whiteness does is it blinds you to the experiences of other people of color. And how do you do that? How do you break it down for someone that, as a person of color, particularly as an African American, all kinds of situations are different, all kinds of mundane situations from buying a house? I remember distinctly going to buy a house in the Delta and a realtor showing us certain properties. And then we had white friends who were also buying a house, and they, from the same realtor, got shown completely different properties. And how do you explain that to someone? Because your experience as a person of color is invisible to them.
Right.
And so that generally, in my experience, comes through personal relationships. When white people get to know people of color and they care about those folks in a personal relationship, whether a friendship, a colleague at work, a partner, then it starts to become real, because now you have some emotional investment because you like this and like this person and respect this person. So what they're saying carries weight. A lot of the problem is, for many white people, they hear about the experiences of black people in America, but it's detached. It's a headline they read, or it's someone they're hearing from who they don't quite trust or know. And so they kind of dismiss it. But the problem is there are more white people that go around than black people. So, you know, one black person is kind of explaining the black experience to all their white friends. And the white individual is like, oh, this is my black friend. They're going to break it down for me, never realizing that this black person has had this conversation 50 other times. So it's exhausting in that sense.
You know, I don't want our discussion to end today without addressing something that I think is front and center for kids, for adults. And this is the way President Trump talks about immigrants. And when he talks about immigrants, he means people of color. He doesn't mean people coming in from Sweden, I sense. Mm-hmm. What do you say to kids about the language that President Trump uses about immigrants, criminals, rapists, they're invading the country? I mean, this is unavoidable in our political life right now. And it has to be addressed with kids so they understand that that is not acceptable. So, Anastasia, maybe you have some thoughts on that. And Jamar, I will get to you before we close.
I tell them that he's lying. And I mean, he believes what he's saying, possibly. I don't know. But what he is saying are lies. And it's wrong what he's doing. And it contributes to extreme violence and harm and damage to people currently who are experiencing the direct effects of his words and his policies and his behavior and how visible and impactful it is.
Jamar, the language is so demeaning and so important. So what do you say to your kids about it?
One of my professors said language, words, create the context for action.
Mm-hmm.
So our words matter, and the words coming from the very highest political office are creating a context of racist, xenophobic action. And so we have to be extremely careful about what we say and how we say it and the assumptions that we're making. So I say that rhetoric matters, that the way we talk, some people would dismiss it as being politically correct. Well, if you look at the root of political correctness, it's an attempt to respect other people. It's an attempt to make sure that we dignify other people. And that ought to be true for us, no matter if we're speaking as an elected official or just as an everyday citizen. You know, the word says, out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. So what are we putting into our hearts? And it's going to come out in our words. So that means we need to be informing ourselves and making sure that we're treating one another with the dignity and respect that every human being deserves.
Jamar, Anastasia, thank you so much. Jamar, I hope to talk again when your book comes out.
Looking forward to it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both.
Thank you. It's so nice to meet you, Jamar.
Likewise.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Carrie at @KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.